Welcome to Widow Too Soon. This is Michelle Boehner Ebersole. I hope you guys are all doing great today. I am not with Mark, as usually I am. He is on vacation, but he'll be back very, very soon. And I just recorded a few days ago, so I don't really have a lot to report since I last recorded. Things are going well. My kids are getting out of school in a couple weeks. We have a choir concert tonight. Oh, this is kind of cool. Haley did her first activity as an incoming senior. They had a candlelight ceremony at her school where the seniors light the juniors' candles and then blow them out. And they're like, this is the class of 2024. So it was kind of cool. But also, I started getting teary-eyed thinking about another graduation without Luke, because we just went through that last year with Hayden. And it definitely brings up the grief and those feelings of like when you see all the parents sitting together and you're not. And even though I have Joel, he wasn't there yesterday, but he'll be at graduation. It's not the same as Haley having her dad. So it brought up a little bit of grief, but overall, we're doing good. So I'm going to get right into the episode. We have a special guest today that I'm very, very excited about. My new friend, Sandy Smith. She is also a widow and has a lot of great stories that I think are going to help you about just persevering, about life, about dating, and just about how to get through this crazy, crazy journey as a widow. So Cindy, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm excited that we found each other on Instagram, even though it took me a little while to get back to you. You know how if you don't know people, it goes in that like other box or the spam box or whatever. I just went through those and found yours. So thanks for being patient and still being here. And also Cindy is a blogger, which she'll get to talk about in a little bit. She wants to help widows with her blogging. So it's awesome. So Cindy, I'd love if you could just start by just telling us your story, about, you know, maybe even backing it up to a little bit about your husband and like how you met and then, you know, your journey that you took with him, and then kind of where you are now as a widow. So that's a lot, but we have as much time as we need. We don't ever have like timed episodes. So I'm going to let you talk and I might just ask some questions as we go, but, thank you for being here. And I'd love to have you share with the audience a little bit about yourself.
Sure. We might have to Uber Eats ourselves some food because it's a long story.
That's all right.
So I met my husband online in 2011. And we were both, I like to say that we were the founding members of Twitter because it was back when Twitter was fun, right? Uh-huh. We actually met under a weight loss hashtag.
Okay.
Cool. And he had lost 200 pounds and I had lost 100 pounds.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. So he was scrolling through Twitter and he saw my picture pop up under the hashtag. And his first thought was, she looks really mean. And then follow. Yeah.
wait, she looks mean. So I'm going to follow.
So I'm going to follow. Funny. He's glutton for punishment from the beginning. So
yeah,
we started a friendship and we talked, we would update each other on our weight loss and then slowly it evolved. I don't think either one of us really realized that it was evolving because at the time he lived in Oxford, England and I was in Atlanta, Georgia. So it seemed like just a long distance friendship at the time. So
yeah,
we, at one point he was going on dates. I was going on dates. I had been married and divorced at that time. Mm-hmm. And he went on a blind date and I was on my way. I was driving myself to go meet a guy that I had no business at all going out with. Anyway. And he called me because of the time difference. I said, how'd your date go? Mm-hmm. He said, oh, she stood me up. And I said, like, it just fell out of my mouth. I was like, that's crazy. I'd never do that to you.
Wow.
He said, I would cut off my arm for a girl like you. And aww. I took the very next exit on the freeway and turned around and went home and we talked on the phone all night.
Oh, I love it.
So, yeah. So the decision was made for him to come visit.
Mm-hmm.
And at first he was just going to come and visit Atlanta for 30 days. And he did. And we had the most amazing summer ever. But by the end of his visit, he had extended his stay until 12:59 on the 90th day, which is the latest. He had 1 minute left to legally be in the
U.S. before
he had to go. Yeah. So he flew back home and he was there for about 8 weeks and then he came back permanently.
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't, and then my daughter was born a year later. So I my entire family thought he was an axe murderer and then he was going to kill me.
Oh my goodness.
And I don't know what, I'm not the person that usually would even consider mm-hmm. dating anyone that way. And at that time, online dating wasn't that much of a thing, right?
Yeah. Like,
people really were, you know, getting in themselves in lots of trouble by dating strangers, but it worked out and we had a really wonderful life together. We had one daughter. We went through 4 years of fertility treatments and we tried to have another baby and we couldn't. We had multiple losses. And at the time, I remember being so angry at God, but now looking back, I know it was protection because I know that I didn't know at the time that I was going to have to raise a child on my own.
Right.
And it's still not easy, but it's much easier to raise one than it is to raise five like we wanted.
Right.
Okay. You know, so he was diagnosed with cancer in January of 2018. And we had very little warning. He worked for the railroad and I mean, he had a very physical job. He never had really health problems. He had a few weird things happen before his diagnosis, but it was mainly like he always ate the very hottest, spiciest vindaloo, like Indian food. And all of a sudden he couldn't do that anymore.
Okay.
Excuse me. So he went to the doctor at 33 years old and he said, "Hey, I'm having this terrible heartburn. Like I can't, you know, if I eat spicy food, it upsets my stomach." And they prescribed him an antacid and sent him on his way at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So a few months after that, we went to Disney World for our family vacation. Just, you know, I was so excited. We'd saved all year, right? And while we were there, it was the year that everyone was getting the flu so bad and the flu was killing people, right?
Yeah.
So I got the flu and ended up in the ER.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I was having a big pity party for myself in the hotel room because I had to stay behind while he and my daughter went and rode rides and went to the amusement parks. But looking back now, I'm like, wow, he needed that time with her. It was like the last little bit of normalcy, right?
Right.
So on the way home from Florida, I was better, but he got worse. He had it as well. And his just continued to progress. Right. So we took him to the doctor and they prescribed him Tamiflu. And Tamiflu is not regularly taken or prescribed in England. It's not really a thing that they do. So he had never had it before. So when he started to have a very violent reaction, we thought it was to the Tamiflu.
Mm-hmm.
So I rushed him to the emergency room with just terrible symptoms. I mean, he felt like at that point that he was dying. And he was severely dehydrated. They dropped several bags of fluid in him and sent us home and said, discontinue the Tamiflu. Well, less than 24 hours later, he was throwing up blood.
Oh, no.
So we went to the ER that night. And I still really don't know how physically I did it, but he couldn't walk. And he was 6'4", you know, 280 pounds. And I basically dragged him out of the house and put him in the car because I had my daughter at the time. She was 4 and I couldn't leave her at home. There was no time to get a sitter, right? So at the ER, they did several tests and scans and they found a blockage in his colon.
Oh.
Yeah. So initially they were telling us that the blockage in his colon must be from being severely dehydrated because he got dehydrated so fast. It must just be food. Right. Mm-hmm. And they sent us to another hospital by ambulance for removal of this blockage. Right. No one ever said cancer because we're looking at a 33-year-old guy.
Right.
That's otherwise very healthy. In the middle of the surgery to remove the blockage, the surgeon came out to talk to me and had me very quickly sign paperwork agreeing to place an ileostomy bag on him.
Oh, wow.
And I was very confused. I was like, well, what are we, you know, first of all, I had to Google what an ileostomy bag was. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm like, what are we talking about? And he was like, I think it's cancer.
Oh my goodness.
And I remember vividly because it was still during this terrible flu outbreak. And while he was in surgery, I told all my family, I said, no, don't come up here because if this is the flu and it's this bad, you guys are going to get sick too. So I was sitting alone in the surgical waiting room. And I remember feeling a shift between what we had before and now. Mm-hmm. It was almost like a switch flipped of this is your happy life and it's gone. Right.
Yeah.
So he almost died a couple times on that hospital stay. And about a week later, they confirmed his diagnosis of stage 4 colon cancer.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he fought very hard. We did every treatment, you know. I told him he went through two very aggressive rounds of chemo. And I'd always told him, I said, when you're done, when you've had enough, you tell us. It's your choice. You have the choice. Like, we weren't going to make him do anything. But he fought really hard. And people would see him, like, we would be at church and he'd be running around and chasing the kids in the youth group. Mm-hmm. And people would go, that guy has cancer. Like, you couldn't tell. Right. He was still very active. He, you know, ran the Rump Shaker 5K. In our city, and you know, to support colon cancer research. He was just very, you know, he was an amazing person before cancer, but cancer just magnified who he was, and he really could have just laid in the bed and done nothing, and he chose to take it as a sign and as a reason to tell everyone about colon cancer and how dangerous it was and how it's not an old man's disease like people think it is. And I think one of the most poignant things that happened during his illness was that he was raised in England, and they're, you know, they're raised under Church of England. They go to Church of England schools. It's a lot like this church, right?
Right.
He called it forced Christianity, you know. He believed in God, but he didn't have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and he didn't know enough. I mean, he was like, yes, church, I go, we sit, we stand, we kneel, whatever. And he was very angry. He was angry at God.
Yeah.
At that moment about his diagnosis, despite his pretty good attitude about everything else, that was a major roadblock. And we kept having this guy come, you know, one of the pastors from our church would come and talk to us and say, you know, what can we do to help? And I remember looking at him one day and I said, I think he's going to die. And I think we need to worry about his eternity. And I need you to help me. Yeah. I said, I need you to help me get him to know Christ so that we don't have to worry about that.
Wow.
And there were times, because it was up and down, chemo was terrible, right?
Uh-huh.
There were times, his name was Jeff. He's still one of our very best friends. He's on staff at our church. And there were times Jeff walked into the house and Matt yelled at him to leave.
Mm.
I mean, he pushed back. And he wanted nothing to do, you know, he was very angry at God. And, you know, we've been taught our whole lives that we're not allowed to be angry at God, but I don't find that to be true.
No, I think I don't either.
To question God, right?
Yep. He can handle it. Yep.
Yeah. So, when one Sunday morning, like I basically dragged him to church every Sunday. I said, you know, I'm doing this. I'm doing everything I can possibly do. Just go and listen. Right.
Yeah.
And one Sunday morning, he texted Jeff and he said, I believe.
Mm.
Yeah. So, So he was baptized.
Oh,
and he told his, you know, they took a video. He shared his testimony. And it was a very comforting knowing.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a very comforting thing knowing that he got it. And that we didn't have to worry about his eternity, right? So we continued treatment until they told us that there was nothing else we could do. And then we had heard at one of his last surgeries, I randomly ran into this man in the waiting area when he was having surgery to drain the fluid on his lungs. And he struck up conversation. And I found it odd because, you know, usually in hospitals, you're not talking to
doctors
in the hospital. You're all there for different reasons.
Uh-huh.
This guy started talking to me and he said, what are you in for? And I told him my husband has colon cancer and, you know, whatever. And he looked at me and he said, I had colon cancer and I was healed by going to Colorado for this treatment. it's alternative treatment called mistletoe therapy, right? Yes, it sounds crazy. It's European mistletoe therapy. And he showed me, he went home that day and came back to the hospital because we were there for a few days with a stack of paperwork showing the progression of his disease and how it healed it.
Wow.
Yeah. So our last ditch effort was that, but right. it cost $10,000. And man, we raised $10,000 in 2 weeks. We had lemonade wow. stands, sales, everything. We got to Colorado and it was too late. He tried, but had we known about that beforehand, had we known about that when he was first diagnosed, I really, truly think we would have had a shot, you know?
Yeah.
But it, you know, it allowed us to have that time with him in Colorado.
Yeah.
It was a whole body therapy. So he got massages and was comforted at that time.
Yeah.
But while we were there, his oxygen, he couldn't, I don't know if it was the altitude, his lungs got worse. And we took him to the emergency room and they told me, they said, you need to get him back. Where's home? And I said, Alabama. They said, you need to get him back as fast as possible. And he can't fly.
Oh, wow.
So we had flown out for the treatment, yeah. right? He was on oxygen at that point. And he needed continuous oxygen. So, I will never not sing the praises of Enterprise Rental Car because we called them and told them the situation. And they said, here's the address, go pick up a car. And we drove a one-way rental that we didn't pay a dime for from,
wow.
yeah, from Colorado back to Alabama. And amazing. I remember looking at him in the rearview mirror on the way back, because I drove and he loved a road trip, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he had always wanted to drive across America. And he was finally getting to do it and he couldn't hold his eyes open.
Mm.
So we planned our stops as we went along the way to make sure we were really close to a cancer center or a level one trauma center.
Right.
Because I knew that if anything happened, he needed that kind of care, right? We got back home. And we went to the ER the next day. We got home, kept him on, he was on oxygen. The next day we went to the ER and his whole medical team was there. We're very fortunate. We live in Birmingham, Alabama, and we have University of Alabama at Birmingham. It's a premier medical school. They have an amazing cancer center.
Mm.
And we all met. We met with everyone. I mean, the room was full. Everyone was here. His parents were here, And he told me, he looked at me from the bed and he said, I think I'm done. And I knew that I had to honor my vows and my promises to him in that moment, because I feel like when people get married they think, oh, better for worse, whatever. Yeah. But yeah, you really don't have that. Your vows are really not tested,
right,
until you're in that situation, right? Yep.
100%. Mm-hmm.
So all along the way, I wanted to make sure everyone, I didn't want after the fact for anyone in our family to be able to say, well, you didn't do this or you didn't do that. So every decision we made is a group, right?
Okay.
I'm like, yeah. He says this, we have to honor this. So everyone's on the same page. And he went home on hospice.
Mm-hmm.
But something happened after he went home on hospice. It's almost like the decision and knowing he didn't have to be tortured with more chemo or treatment gave him a boost, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So most people, they tell you, we'll call the hospice nurses, call you to come visit or to come, do your visits or whatever. And they would call him and he'd say, they call his cell phone and we didn't have a house phone. And he'd say, I'm at Home Depot. And they said, Mr. Smith, you're supposed to stay home. And that's, he's so like, funny. I'm not staying home. I feel good. We're going out. Right. And it just, it was very, I mean, he stayed on hospice so long that insurance kicked him off because he didn't die fast enough, mm-hmm. which he thought was hilarious, right?
Mm-hmm.
So towards the end, he had done everything he wanted to do. We actually, because he was from England, towards the end, he started asking to go home. He wanted to go back to England and there was no way, right?
Yeah.
His parents were there with us. So we were all there together. And there is a British shop in Atlanta where we lived and started our marriage, and it's amazing. They have British foods and stuff. And we called them and we said, hey, do you have any British sausages? Cause that's what he wanted. He wanted like British bacon, sausages, all his food from his childhood. And we explained the situation. And I said, okay, we're going to send somebody over there to get it. And 2 hours later, they were sitting on our doorstep with a box of British things. They drove over from Atlanta. Yeah.
That's amazing.
So little things like that along the way helped, you know, but he declined. And it was like watching the end of a slow, sad movie. And yeah. He begged us not to go back to the hospital. He didn't want to die in the hospital.
Right. My husband either. I get it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and we honored his wishes, right? I mean, what do you do?
Like, right. You know,
we had hard talks in those last few weeks. He gave me permission to do a lot of things that I couldn't even imagine. I mean, like he called me into the bedroom one day while he was on hospice and he pulled his oxygen off. So I knew it was serious because he needed to really talk. Right. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, was he going to tell me, is there a love child somewhere? Like, has he second mortgaged the house? And I don't know about it. Right. And he said to me, he said, when I die, I want you to move on. And I remember being so mad at him. And I said, how can you say that? I'm losing my whole life. It's falling apart. And you're telling me to move on. And he said, I don't want you spending the rest of your life grieving the likes of me. You have to move on.
Wow.
Be happy. And man, I don't know if I could say the same thing. I would be the one that was like, I'm haunting you from the grave.
Right. Yeah.
But it gave me permission. That's when it was amazing. When I did start dating again, I kept remembering those words. And, you know, yep. He made it clear to his parents that that's what he wanted for me. And they've been nothing but supportive. And it was like a gift. I didn't know I needed that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And on a Saturday afternoon in August, he died in our living room, surrounded mm-hmm. by everyone that he loved, including our daughter was there as well. She was six at the time. And when they pulled him out of our house to take him, you know, because he had chosen to be cremated, mm-hmm. when they pulled him out of our house, the sky was pink. It was like pink and orange with these streaks. And I took a picture. I'm like, it's like he was going, it's like he had gotten home, right? And I think a lot about the last breath he took because we were waiting. So it was agonizing, just waiting, mm-hmm. you know. And the hospice nurse kept telling us, she said, he won't die in front of his mother. People don't die in front of their moms. The mom usually walks out of the room or something happens and then it happens. Well, she said had been her experience. Well, his mother stepped out on the back patio to call his brother and give him an update. And he hadn't opened his eyes in hours. And he took the biggest breath and said, he raised his shoulders up off the hospital bed. And me and his dad were watching him. Because I'm like, if nobody was with me, I would think I was seeing things. And his eyes got really big and he looked really excited. And then that was it.
Wow. Like he saw heaven or something.
Saw it. Yeah.
Wow.
Before that, I had, like any other Christian, I was like, you know, you always question. You're like, well, what if it's not real? What if it's not what we think it's going to be?
Right.
In that moment, that was all the confirmation that I needed. Because I believe wholeheartedly that he saw Jesus in that moment.
Wow.
But before he died, he had also given me a ridiculous list of places to spread his ashes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a really funny guy. He
sounds like.
Yeah, so he I think he made this list and made me promise. I don't know if it was the fentanyl talking at the end, right. Or morphine, like whatever.
Yeah.
He was in a significant amount of pain, so they had him on all this medication. And so he wanted me to spread him at the Floribama, which is a bar in South Alabama on the beach. It's not exactly a high class facility. he wanted me to spread him in the waters there. He wanted to be spread on Bourbon Street in New Orleans because he loved New Orleans, right?
Uh-huh.
He wanted to be made into bullets and shot out of a gun because he
built
a gun. I know. It was all this ridiculous stuff. And his mom told me, she was like, you know, you don't have to do any of these things. And I said, yes, I do, because I told him that I would. So we've made it about halfway through the list.
Oh my goodness.
I haven't gotten arrested yet, but we've done some some pretty questionable things at this point. So, yeah.
What about the gun one? Like, how does that even put in a bullet? Is that possible?
Apparently it is. I have not done that one yet.
Yes.
He wanted to be shot out in his favorite field where he and one of his best friends would go shooting guns, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. So I haven't done that one. He like the Bourbon Street one I did.
Oh, nice.
I had never dealt with cremated remains before. So I polled all my mom friends. I was like, how do I do this? What do I do? Like, I don't want to open the box. Like, what do I do? Right. And one of my mom friends decided that the most, logical way was to put some remains in a empty Parmesan cheese container. So, so that's what we did. Okay. So the problem with that is that we were in New Orleans and we were walking up and down Bourbon Street and we're like, how are we going to do this?
Just right.
And I accidentally opened the wrong side. So instead of sprinkling it, clunked.
Oh no.
Yeah. It's been an adventure.
Yes. Sure. He sounds very funny.
It was hilarious. So one of the places, we had his memorial service in England when we went to England. We had one here for his friends in stateside. And then we had one in England in Wales, actually, on the beach where he played as a kid. So we had spread some of his ashes there, with all of his childhood friends. And just really, you know, he was such a sentimental person.
Sounds like it.
I think he gave us all these places to spread his ashes to make us travel and do things and not have an excuse to just sit home, right?
Yeah.
Because I started thinking, like, okay, how are we going to do this without getting arrested, right? Like, so, but yeah, it's, I never thought that I would be carrying a box of cremated remains through the airport.
Right.
But I did. And what was actually awesome about that, because he told me to split his remains with his parents. And I was like, well, which part do I get? Right. Like, which, how do you know?
Yeah. So
I did that. And I couldn't put him on the floor of the plane. It just didn't sit right with me. Right.
Right.
So I just held the box. Well, everyone, you know, the pilot and the flight attendants, they all knew ahead of time because we, that you're carrying remains.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they were really, I mean, TSA was awesome, like the way they handled it, because my daughter was with me, and that she had no idea that anything, that they were checking anything, but they have to, right?
Yeah.
And every flight attendant and every, and the pilots came back to speak to us and said, the pilot said, we're going to get you home, we're going to get him home as quick as possible, right?
That's so nice.
And at the end of the flight, they held the plane and they had an announcement, you know, they explained that they were taking a British citizen home to his final resting place, and they had a stand up. And that was very I mean, the flight attendants walked by when the plane landed and touched the box and said, welcome home.
Oh wow, yeah, it was beautiful. Beautiful.
It's pretty awesome. I mean, I expected nothing, and the kindness, right? It was just, wow.
What a beautiful but heartbreaking story, but I see so much beauty. My favorite thing is how when the pastor, I believe you said Jeff, asked, is there anything we can do? You said, we need to get, you know, his eternity figured out, you know, and I love that you we're thinking big picture and like eternity, and really, you know, whether he wanted to go to church or not, you brought him, and eventually he was saved and we know where he is.
Yeah.
And that is so, so beautiful. The love that you had and have, you know, it never stops, you know, the love we still have for our spouses. It's so beautiful what I see in you, just this wonderful story. And I see so much joy too. Like, God has brought you these little glimpses and these little gifts throughout the way. Now I'd love to know, okay, so that's your story up until then, but then what was it like your first few days as a widow? Like, what, just walk us through the first little bit as a widow, what life was like for you.
When my husband died on a Saturday, we promised him that we would continue to go to church. So on Sunday, the whole family got up and we all went to church.
Wow.
And our church surrounded us by so much love and support, you know. On Monday, we planned the funeral. or his celebration of life, which he insisted he didn't want any. He wanted everyone to dress in bright colors because he didn't want to scare our daughter with all black. Right. Yeah. Everyone did that. And on Tuesday we had the funeral. And Wednesday my daughter started first grade.
Oh, wow.
And on that Wednesday, I also went to work as a preschool teacher after not working her entire life. And she was sick.
Oh my goodness.
That's a lot. So my way of handling it, I do not recommend, but I thought mm-hmm. that if I could just power through it, that I could get over it faster. Mm-hmm. I was determined not to let it break our family.
Mm-hmm.
I was determined not to let it destroy my daughter's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was doing a pretty good job. I look back now and I see all the mistakes I made because I had no guidance. I mean, how do you, nobody swooped in and told me, let's sit down and talk about your financial paperwork and how to protect yourself. And let's sit down right. and, come up with a plan. People checked on us. But I guess what I didn't expect is the friends you have before an illness like that are much different than the friends you have during an illness like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happens after the funeral, because for everyone else, that's the finality of it.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But for you, it's not. So we lost a lot of our couple friends because all yes. of a sudden I'm the odd man out. Uh-huh. Like all of a sudden I'm a threat to, be around us, I guess, or they just couldn't relate to us anymore. Or right. they didn't say, I think most people have good intentions.
Right.
But everyone disappeared. And I remember the Friday night after he died, I was sitting folding clothes, and I was actually folding the clothes that we had had on him before he died. I mean, and I remember thinking that night, I was like, laundry doesn't stop for anything, right?
Like, true.
Like it just keeps yeah. going. And there was no one there. And, to my family's credit, his parents had been in America so long, they had to go back to England.
Yeah.
His grandmother was ill 2 weeks after he died. His grandmother died. They were going through it too, right? My family lived a couple hours away. Like, they can't all quit their jobs and take care of me,
Yeah.
But I wish that I would have been strong enough, or I wish at that time that I wouldn't have thought that I was being so strong and I would have asked for help.
Right.
Because my blanket answer, when anybody asked me if I was okay, I would say, yeah, sure, I'm great. Because I thought I told myself that I would be.
Right.
So what happened for me is I had never really been a huge drinker.
Mm-hmm.
But I started having a glass of wine at night after my daughter went to bed. And that turned into two, which turned into four, which turned into I'm drinking a Boda Box before daylight because I couldn't sleep.
Right.
The doctor, my personal doctor was like, oh, wow, your husband just died. So when I called to ask for something to help, they threw a Xanax prescription.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Xanax and wine together is like a recipe for disaster, right? And I very quickly became dependent on both of those things. And I remember walking through church a couple of weeks after he died, and I wasn't drunk because I only drank at night.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been taking the prescribed Xanax in the amount that I was told to. And it was like I was in a daze, and I was smiling, and people were looking at me like, what is wrong with her? Her husband just died. And nobody stepped in and said, hey, let's sit down and talk about this. Everyone's kind of giving me my space, and I was on a quick road to self-destruction. I can't tell you in those first few months what my child ate for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I know that she made it to school sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably the world's worst employee because I called in all the time.
Yeah.
But everyone around me seemed to just be giving me room to get over it or to self-destruct or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that someone would have tough loved me a little bit, but I don't know if I would have listened at that point. Right.
Right.
Yeah, it was pretty terrible. I look back on it now and I feel so bad, because at the time where my daughter really needed mom to be worried about her emotions, I wasn't mentally capable of being that person for her. And I'm really grateful for the other moms in my friend group that stepped in mm-hmm. and helped with her. I'm really grateful for, we have a, you know, we both have faith-based board certified counselors that we've seen
from
the very beginning. And I'm very grateful that God placed those women in our lives because she needed that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of my, my lowest moment, one of my lowest moments, when he was sick was we had gotten super bad news, right? They told us that there was nothing else we could do. No chemo was working. And I left the house that day and I drove up to the top of a mountain near our house. And I was sitting there. I wanted to die, right? Like multiple times throughout this process, I've wanted to die. And I was sitting there. My daughter was at home with him. I just needed away from it because I was overwhelmed, right?
Uh-huh.
And in that moment, I stuck a gun in my mouth. And I said to myself, I was like, you know, this is the way out of the pain, right? Wow. We're all going to die. You know, this is the way out. And right before I pulled the trigger, my phone rang and it was my daughter asking me if we could go get ice cream when I got home.
Wow.
Yeah. So after that happened, the rest of his illness, if she asked for ice cream at 9 p.m., guess where we went?
Yeah.
Pajamas, right? So after, when I was drinking heavily, after he died, I had many, many more nights where I was fighting that.
Yeah.
And I can see, looking back now, I really had to just pull myself out of it because I wasn't comfortable enough sharing that with anybody at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was very hard mentally. It was very hard mentally to look at myself and say, this pain is not going to last forever. It's going to ease. It'll always be there. There'll always be a dull pain, but it's mm-hmm. not going to be that overwhelming, crushing.
Right.
Right. Like,
mm-hmm.
and I used to think that if I let go of that overwhelming, crushing feeling, that I was somehow not honoring my husband's legacy.
Yeah.
But he didn't want us to be in pain forever.
Right. Wow. And I think that's a common thing that people think, that if they can't let go of the pain, they think letting go of the pain is letting go of their late spouse, but it's really letting go of the pain so that you can live life. John 10:10. That's one of my verses I love from my nonprofit. We talk about, it says something about, Jesus came to give us life and live life abundantly. Like, we didn't, like widows, we're not here because like our husband died. Now we're just going to survive until it's our turn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we need to thrive. And like, I'm so happy that you were able to come out of that darkness. Cause it's something you can't explain to people. And I know the listeners right now are like, yes, I get that. The darkness and that feeling of like, I don't want to live anymore. Like, mm-hmm. and sometimes our kids that are the reason we keep living.
And it's the only reason, honestly.
Yeah. And I can relate to that, like not being emotionally there for your kids, because you're dealing with your grief and theirs. Mm-hmm. And so it's really overwhelming, and it is hard to be able to be there for both of those. So what do you think is the biggest thing? Your daughter, definitely, like you said, that got you through it. But what else? Like, what is that, the single thing that pulled you out of this? Like the drinking with the Xanax and all that, or were there like other factors, like other people or other, like, I don't know, anything else that helped you get out of that?
I got really good at putting on a facade and telling mm-hmm. everyone that I was fine, even though it was really, really evident that I was not.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that it pushed me closer to God
mm-hmm.
and it made me lean more heavily on the word of God to pull me through. And I mean, there were nights where I was face down on the bathroom floor, you know, right. and I had this moment where I was face down on the bathroom floor with a gun beside me. I wanted to die. I didn't want to be, you know, I rationalized. I said, you know, my daughter's going to be fine because my in-laws will take care of her. They're wonderful people. Like, she'll have anything she ever dreamed of in life. And of course she wouldn't have her mother or her dad, so that'd be terrible. Yeah. But in my head at the time, it made sense.
Right.
And I remember thinking all of those things. And then the story about the healing at the pool flooded into my brain, and it just over and over again, I kept hearing, if you want to be made well, get up and walk.
Ooh, wow. Yeah. I love that.
And that's become so much of a mantra for us the last few years, because, you know, grief sickness is a sickness. Like, it's, you know, mental health, especially in this country, is not really accepted still or identified as valid, but it is life altering, and you really truly have to do the work to get through it. But I started listening to, you know, during his sickness, we listened to every kind of Christian music possible. I mean, one of the songs that was, you know, absolutely helped bring him to Christ was "Death Was Arrested" by North Point.
Yeah, that's a good song.
And we went to one of their concerts while he was sick. And he actually, I had messaged the guys ahead of time and said, "Hey, we're coming. This song helped lead him to Christ. He's sick." And they came out and met him and explained like how they wrote the song and stuff. And then when we got to the day of his memorial service, when we got there, they were there to sing the song in his service.
Oh my goodness. That's amazing.
And so when I found myself in the same low place, right, in the lowest of lows, I remember there was a time where I listened to that song 30 times in a row. I mean, like, I just kept playing it and playing it and playing, because I had to be reminded of what Jesus did for me to be here, and like how I'm supposed to use my talents and use my story and use my testimony to hopefully help other people. And I've spoken at events about suicide and about mental health. And I hope that my story has reached at least one person who has found themselves on the floor, because sometimes all you need is like a little bit of hope that the future is going to be a little bit better, you know?
Right. Well, I know that your story is going to touch so many listeners who have probably never even told anyone that they've been in the place that you have been. And because of your courage to be honest and open about that, I know it's going to help others, because I know a lot of, I didn't exactly feel like exactly the same, but I remember the thoughts of like, I don't want to die, but I don't want to live. Like, sure. I don't want to be here, you know? And so I know your story is going to touch so many people. So I want to fast forward to what is life like? How long has it been, and what does life look like for you now?
Okay. He will be gone 4 years this August.
Okay.
Now life is good. We have moved on to, you know, I've dated some real duds. I did the hard work so other people don't have to.
Yeah. We'd love to hear a little bit about that real quick, if you want to share, or not real quick. Dating stories are very interesting, and I'm sure we can all learn.
So I decided, I knowing nothing about, because I had been married the entire dating website time span. So I had no idea. I didn't know the rules, right? Mm-hmm. And so I signed up for several dating websites when I thought I was ready, I wasn't ready, but I thought I was, right?
Yeah, me too.
And I went on a million bad dates. I went on some really great dates. I have a couple of friends that I met that I'm like, these guys will be my friends for life, because one of the guys that I met on a dating website, he acknowledged immediately. He was like, "Whoa, your husband just died?" Mm-hmm. And he took a step back, you know, like, there are all these people that are predators and they prey on women,
right?
Especially on widows, because we're in such a vulnerable position. We can't even handle our own emotions, much less bring a new person into the mix, right? And this one guy was like, "I'm not going to date you, but you are awesome and we are going to be very good friends." And we have been.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. So I was actually, during my Xanax and wine days, I was sitting at Starbucks before work, because I used to go. I mean, nobody talked to me about a widow budget after he died. So I was going to Starbucks every day, right? So I'm sitting at Starbucks, the food I'm trying to force down my throat to psych myself up to go to work. And a guy came into the Starbucks and sat down beside me. And he acted like he had no idea who I was. It was just this chance meeting, you know, and he struck up conversation. We started talking. We seemed to have a whole lot in common, and very quickly a relationship, you know, bloomed out of that. Mm-hmm. I didn't acknowledge at the time how toxic it was. I mean, anybody who is willing to, you know, get down in the ditch with you, it's really easy to find people that will drink all night with you, You know, it's a lot harder to find people that'll crack a Bible open with you, right?
Uh-huh.
So I was attracting, because that's where I was attracting that type of person, right?
Right.
If you're popping Xanax all night and drinking wine, you can bet that there's some skeezy guy waiting around the corner that will do that with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it, you know, I dated this guy and I found out several months later, through the mail, because he had been taking my mail out of my mailbox, that he had cleaned out my savings account.
That's awful.
And he had started a line of credit in my name. Mm. He had tried to finance a car in my name.
Wow.
I mean, and I had to, like, I remember going to pastors of my church and I said, I was humiliated. I had to tell my in-laws that this happened, you know, like that was our money to live on. It wasn't a lot, right? But it was there.
Oh.
And I remember going to the pastors at my church and I said, I'm humiliated. Everyone's going to hate me. He has children in the community. Like, you know, this is terrible. I just want it all to go away. And one of my pastors said, coming from a biblical standpoint, the Bible tells us we have to hold other believers accountable for their actions.
Mm.
And that gave me the courage and the strength to go to the district attorney and file charges, and the grand jury, you know, indicted him on all charges.
Wow.
We came to, you know, after a 2-year court battle, basically, I got part of my money back, but not all of my money back, but
wow.
The message was loud and clear that that wouldn't be tolerated. And I think that it's really important for widows to be, you know, to be aware of that, because he pretended like he didn't have any idea who I was, but he let it slip a few times that he was actually in our church the day that the entire community prayed over my husband before we went to Colorado for treatment. And he had seen me in Starbucks, and he had gone up to the people at Starbucks and asked them what my name was, things about me. Like, he sought me out for that reason.
Wow. So scary.
Yeah, it was, it turned very violent, because when I did press charges, he, you know, I had to also press felony abuse charges against him, domestic violence charges. And, you know, I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about, you know, things that as parents, we would tell our kids this,
right? Like,
the company you keep is very important. Mm-hmm. I knew that, and I didn't follow my own rule, basically. But that kind of put me off dating for about 10 months.
Yeah, I see why. Scary.
Yeah, it did. At that time, I was still, you know, it was during COVID lockdown. So I was still drinking, but not as heavily. I was out of the woods as far as the wanting to kill myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we got sent home for COVID. We're all being paid to sit at home. I was a teacher. Like, we drank in the driveway all summer long. And I could keep it under control at that point, though. And right. I didn't date. I said, you know, I told my therapist, I said, this is it. Yeah. I'm swearing off men, right?
Uh-huh.
And when I did think I was ready to date again, I met a man who, it was wonderful. I mean, he was a wonderful person. He still is a wonderful person. But a couple of weeks after we started dating and we really started to get serious, he had a loss. He had, his mother died. And all of a sudden, I was seeing what I had just gone through in someone else. And we really tried for about 6 months to make it work. But he was in that spiraling portion of grief
that
I had just pulled myself out of.
Yeah.
And you can't, like, I couldn't pull him out of that.
Right.
And that was hard. That was really hard, because I'm like, in a way, I was like, I can fix this, right? Like, I can.
Yeah.
But you can't fix it. Nobody could have fixed me either, right?
Right.
So I dated some real, real doozies along the way, just like, casually. And then 2 years ago in October, I met my current boyfriend now.
Awesome.
And we have been together since then. And it has been amazing.
That's so great.
We moved in together, and you know, we live in a small town in rural Alabama. We live outside of Birmingham, and you know, everyone wants to know when we're getting married. I'm like, I'm not giving up my social security. It wasn't, so not anytime soon. So
there's that. Yes. And yeah, how, we're in a hurry. How does your daughter do with him? How's that relationship?
She's great. At first, she was very standoffish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought, I was like, oh gosh, it's going to be terrible. She doesn't like him, but they're a lot alike and they like mm-hmm. to, you know, they get at each other, they pick at each other a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a really sweet relationship. I mean, but in no way is he trying to replace my husband.
Right.
But it's great to have like a strong, you know, solid man around.
Yes.
Because
yes.
I think he's a widow. That's a fear. We're like, our children are going to grow up in mm-hmm. terrible situations because they lost their dad, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's been really good. She's very happy and well-rounded, and I really couldn't ask for anything else out of a kid. I mean, she was great in school. It's almost like she tries extra hard, right? It's like mm-hmm. she knows she has to try just a little bit harder because she's carrying mm-hmm. a heavier load than her friends, right?
Right. What I see is a tragic, awful story, but I see joy. Like, that joy can come back. I see joy in your face and the way that you talk and the way that even in the process, there was so much joy, you know, and humor and all kinds of things during your journey. And then I just see joy coming back into your life. And that's such a beautiful, beautiful thing to see, that we can still carry the love for our late spouse and honor them and talk about them and all of that, but we can love someone else. Sure. And it is such a gift that your late husband told you to move on, because I've heard the opposite where husbands, they say, do not move on. And people right. have a really hard time. I'm somewhere in the middle. My husband never said either way.
Right.
It was just too hard for him to talk about. He never brought it up. And so that was a little bit of an issue for me for a while, but I had to realize in his perfect state now, like, he would be happy for me.
Oh,
he would
sure.
want me to. So that's such a gift that your late husband told you that. What would you say is some advice for a new widow? We have a lot of new widows that listen within their first year. What would some advice that you would give them?
Do as I say, not as I do, for sure. After my husband died, I was very focused on getting back to normal. I thought normal was going to be normal again, and it was not.
Yeah.
I did a lot of anticipatory grieving because yeah. we knew he was going to die. Mm. So I thought when he died, that was it. And we could just
okay.
get back to life and we could just move forward. And I actually became the anti-widow because I hated it. I hated carrying the label.
Right.
Talking about it. I hated, you know, it felt like such a burden, and it felt like it drew attention to me that I did not want, because we had just been through a very public cancer battle and our right. community rallied around us, but then our community also knew everything about us and it was uncomfortable to me. So I fiercely protected my privacy, and I was invited to grief share and different things, and I declined every invitation. And I'm going to mm-hmm. say that I think that was the wrong decision. I think I should have, you know, at the time I had people having widows reach out to me, and I kept pushing them away. Mm-hmm. And if I had it to do over again, I would have let the widow community surround me with love, because I was trying to talk about, when I did get ready to talk about my loss, I was talking about it to people who had no idea what I was going through because they had never been through it themselves.
Right.
And I really think that, you know, community is important.
Yes.
I think that, you know, just like when someone's ill and people tell you, like my husband's sick, people said, you just have to learn to say yes. If someone says, hey, I'm coming to cut your grass, you just have to say, okay. If
That's
someone
true.
Says, we're bringing you a meal. I mean, I didn't cook for a year and a half. We had so much work. We're Southern Baptists. We had food piled up on the porch, right? They
wow.
feed you. So I wish that I just would have said yes, because I had people that were trying to point me in the right direction so I could grieve with other widows. And in my head, I thought, well, that's just going to make it worse, because mm-hmm. then I'm an empathetic person. I'm taking on their pain, right? And I find that as I'm further along on my journey, that's not the case, because I find that when I read other stories of widows, or when I see other, you know, watch videos or whatever, that I take away a little piece of something from everyone
yes.
else's story. And I can apply it to my life in different ways, or I can, especially if you're raising children, I mean, there's no what to expect when you're expecting on what to do if your husband dies. There should be, maybe.
That's a good one. Maybe you should write that one. That's
like,
so good.
What should you do? Because how do you know? I mean, like, in different widows are in different stages. So yeah. I think it's important to find your group.
Yeah.
And to find your people. I have a pretty good support system now. Through cancer and death, we've met many other people that, you know, that have become widows as our story has progressed, some before Matt died and some after.
Yeah.
And when I finally let those people in, I started to feel a little less alone. And so I think it's really important to be open to that, even if it's hard to put yourself out there.
Yeah. Well, that's really, really great advice. Can you tell us a little bit about, I know you're a writer. Can you tell me the story you shared with me earlier about how the gift from your husband and how you got back into writing and what you're currently doing?
My husband and I, because we met when I was a weight loss blogger, I used to write a lot about our lives. Well, when my daughter was little, there came a time where I said, you know, I'm telling stories about her life and these aren't my stories to tell. Mm. And she deserves the privacy of being able to one day, this is before cancer, you know.
Yeah.
Something just didn't sit right with me about continuously sharing these stories about my little girl, right? And I walked away from my blog. I said, you know, I'm in the trenches. I'm a mom. I'm going to not do this, right?
Yeah.
The age of the mommy bloggers. So yeah. I stepped back and I didn't write. And writing has always been a form of therapy for me.
Mm-hmm.
And during my husband's cancer journey, one of our doctors said, because my phone was ringing constantly while we were in the oncologist's office, and one of his doctors said to us, he said, you need to pick one platform and share only on that platform.
Mm.
And then you need to walk away from it and not answer your phone, because otherwise you're giving the same information from the doctor's visits to so many different people.
Yes.
So I chose Facebook because it was the easiest way to communicate. Yep,
me
right?
too. Mm-hmm.
And I would update. I would give a daily update on his condition. And then I would turn my ringer on silent so I could have peace. And it worked. And I found myself writing not just an update on his condition. I would share verses because I felt like at that point I had an obligation to talk about all the good things God was doing in our lives through his cancer battle, and to make it not worthwhile, but to make it important, right? To make his struggle be able to touch someone else's life and hopefully lead them to Christ. And that happened several times throughout my sharing. So while he was on hospice, the last few, you know, few weeks before he died, it was actually the last day he was able to go to church because he wanted to go to church. So he was in a wheelchair at that point. We brought him in, walked him in. He couldn't walk all the way down to our seat because we're not back row Baptists. We like to sit right up front so we can pay attention. He looked over at me. He was like, we're back row Baptist today, because he couldn't get any further. Right?
Yeah.
So that day, after he listened to the sermon, he stood up during worship. He raised his hands to God. I mean, it was beautiful to watch. On his way back to the car, as we're wheeling him back to the car in his wheelchair, he looks at me, and I'm expecting him to say something really poignant at this point, because it's just been an emotional thing. He said, hey, I need you to run by Best Buy for me. And I was like, what could you have possibly bought at Best Buy?
Nice.
So I didn't know what I was picking up. I thought it was something for his dad, because, you know, I get there and they hand me a MacBook Air across the counter. And I said, there must be a mistake, because my husband is dying and he would not have purchased this.
Right.
They double checked the information and they said, yep, he did. So I got it home and I said, what are you doing? What is this? He said, that's your anniversary and your birthday, your anniversary, Christmas and birthday present, because I won't be here.
Mm.
And he said, I want you to write again. And I was, at the time, I was like, yeah, okay, I promise you I'll write again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I just stuck it in the safe, because we were in those last few weeks. We didn't know when he was going to die. And I stuck it in our safe. Every time I opened the safe, because after he died, we had all of our paperwork. Everything was in there. So it was constantly in there. I'm like, okay, birth certificate, death certificate, right?
Yeah.
I kept opening the safe, and the way I had it in there, it would fall out and hit me in the foot. I would basically kick it. It was still in the package. I hadn't even busted the plastic. Wow. On it. And I would kick it back in there. And that happened multiple times over the course of about 2 months. And then I was like, okay, Matt, I get it. I need to write it.
Yeah.
I picked it up and I started blogging. I'm not as regular of a blogger as I probably should be, but I do write almost daily now. I'm currently writing a book about our story. I used to think the story of our life was truly how we met and like the fairy tale feeling of marrying him and being married to him and, you know, all of those things. But now I really understand that the true story of our life and what will make the most impact on people is how he died with such dignity.
Yes.
And how he really, truly lived his life. He lived his life for other people and for Christ and not for himself. And I think that's the story that is really going to, you know, make a difference in the lives of other people.
That's beautiful. And it is, I'm also a writer and it is so like, it just so such good therapy for yourself to write and to just like process everything. And you do have such a beautiful, unique story, just the way you guys met. And then just all the amazing things that God put together when he was sick and afterwards. And I think it would be a wonderful book, especially with your openness and honesty about the suicidal thoughts and all of that, the mental health stuff. I think it will help impact a lot of people. So how can we stay in touch with you? So we'll know when your book comes out and all of that. Where can we find you on social media? How can we email you?
Sure.
And I'll also put links in the show notes so people can use those.
Sure. You can email me at blondeblackwidowmedia@gmail.com.
Okay.
Yeah. And you can follow me on TikTok. I post funny TikToks of my daughter and I. We love TikTok.
At
Cindy, C-Y-N-D-I, and Quinn, Q-U-I-N-N, 2.0.
Nice.
Our first one got shut down.
Okay. I will definitely have to find you right away in there. Yeah. I love doing widow TikToks too.
Sure.
And like, I've met a lot of widows on TikToks, like a lot.
Yes, I have too. I don't really direct. It's more silly, funny,
funny things. Yeah.
Some stuff about my husband. There's a lot of things that we promised and we did. Like he always wanted to go to every University of Alabama football game, home game for an entire season. And not this past year, but the year before we did it. I still don't know how we did it. We got fantastic seats for every
game.
That's
amazing.
We had a blast. You can also back read my blog at blondeblackwidow.com.
Perfect. Yeah.
I'm not as regular of a blogger there as I would like to be, but I'm really working on my blog. But I think it's very, you can kind of read through the time, like from when he died, from when the blog started, and you can I look back and I can see my own struggles now, you know.
Yeah.
I can see that I was processing things in the way I was.
Yeah. Well, I love your willingness to be open, because that's when we're able to help other people. Because I always think, like, if I had to go through this, I wanted to help other people.
Sure.
And it seems like you have the same attitude too. Like, we would never, ever choose this life. But because we went through it, we can help those other, as I like to call them, baby widows, who are just in that new part of the journey where you think you won't survive. And your story is going to help so many people. So thank you so much for being here today. I know that a lot of people are going to be impacted by this. So thank you. And just to wrap it up, if you liked this podcast, we always love it if you could give us a little 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen. We're always looking for more guests. You can email us at widowedtoosoonm@gmail.com or Instagram or Facebook, all the places. And hopefully Mark will be back next time, and we'll see you later. Thank you.